Hey there, foreigners! This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. Today's guest is Ravi Trivedi. He's the founder of CouponRonnie.com. Ravi has lived in the US for several years before returning to India to start a venture fund. He also became an entrepreneur himself when he started CouponRonnie.com. CouponRonnie is one of the three largest coupon sites in India currently. And he's here today to talk about his journey through building CouponRonnie. Ravi, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
So in the intro I mentioned, it's one of the three largest sites for coupons. What does that mean? Like, how many visitors do you get a month? Can you give me some numbers?
Sure, great. So we, depending on the month of the year, we get anything between 200,000 to 1.5 million visits a month. And in terms of transactions, we would do anything between 10,000 to 40,000 transactions a month.
I see. So that's a very impressive number. And how many years it took you guys to get there?
No, so I would say we started in 2012, July.
Okay.
And I think we have been hitting these kind of numbers since, say, 2 years. So it took around 2.5 years to get to these numbers. And, you know, growing ever since.
I see. So you are an entrepreneur now. You started CouponRonnie and you're also started a new company 14 months back, Pushing Edge. But it was not always this way, right? At one point, you used to be like a very technical guy. So technical to the point that you actually wrote a book. Tell us about the book you wrote.
Absolutely. So I'll maybe give you guys a 1 minute summary of my background and then get to the book. So I actually, like maybe some of you, I did a master's in computer science and went on to join Hewlett Packard. And I ended up doing some great technical work with them. I was in HP Labs working in, you know, close collaboration with them in the Cupertino office. And that's where, you know, I got exposed to web services. Web services were extremely new at that time and we were kind of the leading, vendor for that. And I was lucky to work on that. And so that's the time when I started thinking about sharing or evangelizing what I was working on. And I actually started doing some trainings and sessions and I started writing articles. And then came an offer where somebody said, hey, you seem to be knowledgeable about this space. Would you like to write a book around it? So that's where I kind of actually co-authored a book on web services security. And that was one of the huge items on my bucket list. But nonetheless, I was very, you know, happy that I was able to do so.
I see. So you were very technical, but then you wanted to move towards the business side of things. How did you end up in the US to do the same?
Sure. So my story, like I said, after my master's, spent several years in Hewlett Packard. I was a technology guy working on real cutting edge stuff, but there was some things that made me think about, and that was around certain failures where I saw that technology was not the silver bullet. It indeed was an enabler for solving a real pain point. And I felt that even though we had the best of the technology ahead of everybody, we actually at some stage, we failed and we were not able to become like the number one vendor in that space. And that made me to think and reevaluate what I really wanted to do. And I actually, because I was doing this on a HP consulting, a role for a short while, I realized that as a consultant, you interact with your clients a lot more and understand and solve some of the pain points they have. I decided to switch to a business development / pre-sales kind of a role. And again, the switch was extremely hard. As you can imagine, in a large organization with somebody with no MBA, but I was able to convince my management and make a switch because I felt I was the right person who understood technology. And now if I could understand the customer, now I was able to, you know, mash them together and come up with something that's a win-win for everybody.
I see. So how did you end up in the US?
So I actually had come to the US when I was developing the web services technologies. More specifically, I was working on a product called eSpeak, which was open source by HP in those days. And I was actually in that group. And I actually moved to business development when I moved back to India. And that's when I started doing some of the other stuff. But in US, I was a technical person working on a product. And apart from that, in the second stint, I actually worked on a client with a client using eSpeak and building the first solution.
Oh, I see. So you're talking about the first time you came to the US through HP to develop your business. Your long stint, however, was the second time when you came to do an MBA, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so the story goes post, you know, I joining. So I had to convince my management to put me into pre-sales and marketing role. I convinced them and I said, you know what, I will also join an IIM Bangalore executive MBA to make sure, which was a weekend MBA where I used to go to classes on Friday, half day and Saturday. And they were generous to give me half day Friday off and allow me to do it so that while I was doing this role, I was also making sure my functional skills were up to there. And again, it was a interesting time. I enjoyed my work, but I realized, you know, the part-time thing was great, but I wanted more of a full-time, you know, just an immersed experience. So I actually decided to do a 2-year full-time MBA, not even a 1-year, yeah. Even though by then I had around 6 years of experience. And that's when, you know, I looked at schools like Duke, which is where I ended up, you know, doing my MBA. I loved Duke because it had strong focus on general management. Also, it was very strong in marketing, which is a field which I actually wanted to pursue post my MBA. But as most people know who go for MBA, as you go inside, you look at various options. And I fell in love with, and I felt that I was a natural when it came to numbers, and I decided to pursue a Wall Street option or a finance career.
Ravi, before you go into Wall Street, I just want to mention, so you did a part-time MBA for 1 year and decided, okay, maybe full-time is better and quit halfway, right?
Yes.
I'm about like 6 years have been working, and I talked to a lot of people who did MBA, you know, who are a few years ahead of me. And all the folks who have done part-time MBA say to me that if I were to go, if they were to go back, they would do a full-time MBA.
Absolutely.
But they did part-time anyway because they decided and jumped in, right? But kudos to you for actually switching halfway through once you had that realization, because it's very hard to make such a drastic change, right?
No, absolutely. And IMB is a top brand. To be very honest, I had that in my mind to some extent. But I will tell you this. See, the lure of getting a monthly salary is so strong. Everybody looks at the opportunity cost. And even then, you know, forget my friends. Even my parents would ask me time at times, you know, you got 6 years, you're making so much. Why do you want to go to a zero salary and pursue an MBA and take a debt of so much, right?
Yeah.
But I feel, you know, it's the same passion or same belief in myself and what I am interested about that has driven me all along. But again, the good thing I would say in my case is that the story worked out. So, but there are also cases where it might not. So I won't call it like a given, but that being said, I am at least happy that I did what I felt. And for me, it was really good because when I went to Duke, I was able to actually do not one, but multiple internships, explore not only Wall Street career, but also venture capital. And that actually ended up helping me in actually getting a venture capital job. And so, I really thoroughly enjoyed. And apart from that, as you know, it is a truly international school. And I made a ton of friends and I was super active in school days and I really enjoyed it. So
they say the best part of doing an MBA is one of the best parts is building the network.
Absolutely.
Of friends, right? So you were in US for like 9 years, I believe, right? So like we hear from many people who return back to India, did you wait till the day you got your green card and on the day you got your return?
You know, it's funny you ask. So I was kind of brute force or whatever, so cowboyish or whatever you call it, that I actually said, if I want to go back, and I had made this mind before I went in, A, partly because I was the only child of my parents. Uh-huh. B, I saw my parents both had gone to the top schools like IIT Kanpur and BITS Pilani, and they were the only one from their batch who were back in India. And I said, you know what, they did it for their family. I'm also going to come back. Why do I need even a green card? So I never actually filed for a green card. So that was not even an option. If I hadn't come back when I came, after a year, the US laws would have, you know, asked me to anyway move out. But that was kind of a good thing because it's the same stuff, right? You do a part-time MBA, you say, oh, maybe I'll keep the job and I'll do an MBA. It's like doing two things at a time where you do none of them well. So I said, fine, I'm going to come back, then come back full. So that's kind of...
It was kind of, it's called like a positive constraint, right? So you mentioned that in 1 year, US would have kicked you out, which means you're talking about the expiry of your H1 visa, which has 6 years.
Absolutely.
If you didn't have the courage enough to make the decision in the moment, which happens to all of us, right? It's not a courage thing. It's just you're stuck in the situation. Then there is like a kind of a deadline which kind of pushes
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. No, it's the best thing because once I've made a decision, I'm like 100% with it and I live with it, right? And some people may ask, you know, maybe it's an insurance. I'm like, why do I need an insurance? See, today it's so much easier to build a business globally. And if tomorrow there is a need for me to be in US to build a business, I could be doing it from here or elsewhere. So my point was straight. But I think in a way it was good because it made sure that I followed what I had actually intended to do.
Got it. Right? So, I agree with you. So, what you did, like you mentioned, right, it's people say that it's an insurance which helps make them indecisive in some way. But what you did by not having it is setting a constraint for yourself so that you actually follow through. It's like if you want to quit smoking, you go tell everyone that you're quitting. So that the stakes of not doing it are picking up a cigarette again are very high.
And in fact, that is the technique I follow. Yeah. In fact, I've been since January 1, I know it's kind of sidetracked. I've been on a mission to lose weight. And I told everybody in and around me because they'll keep me honest.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, so it's been a month and I've lost 4 kgs. So that's the kind of work that has. So your point is spot on, right? Because if you do some of those stuff, you make sure you remain honest to yourself. So
you returned to India and at that time in US, you were working on a venture fund. Is that why you started a venture fund in India also, or did you have too much money from your Wall Street debt that you wanted to
invest? I wish. See, all the money from Wall Street went into paying college loans, right? And that was part of the reason I did Wall Street also. Although I will begin by saying my Wall Street experience was also fabulous. Extremely great set of folks I worked with, the best, you know, in terms of ethics, in terms of culture, in terms of diversity. It was among the best, right? The only reason I switched from Wall Street to venture was because I was looking more at longer term investing horizon, where I could leverage some of my background in technology and make longer bets, right? So when I move back, technically what I do as Srijan Capital as the main entity, I'm not a venture fund. I'm not a registered venture fund. I actually do individual angel investment as an individual, right? So I want that to be kind of very clear because what happens is, I came back and said, my real interest is in entrepreneurship. And I had this opportunity to actually be an entrepreneur or close to be an entrepreneur while I was with a venture fund. They had asked me to run an online division. And that's what I got so interested about.
What is the difference for someone who is not familiar? What is the difference between a venture fund and an angel?
So venture is something that actually operates at slightly later stage where your average investment is between $1 to $5 million and you're looking at companies who are probably doing maybe $250,000 to $1 million in revenue already. Angel is somebody who's prior to that, who's probably putting something between a 250K to $500,000 or maybe 750K size, but there is a group, maybe 10 or 20 people who put together and that they're putting it either slightly post the idea stage or at a stage where maybe you have got, you know, 10 or 15 paying customers. So that's kind of where the angels operate. And so I kind of moved the stage back when I moved back and do angel investing in India.
Which year was this?
So I moved back in 2011. And that was, you know, around July, I mean, around, you know, the summer of 2011, I moved back. And I started, you know,
Was the goal to raise money from others to invest also, or were you just focused on investing your own?
No, so that's a great question. See, the real thought at that time was, and I actually did a kind of an A-B test. That's the real story. So I actually said, how about I consider raising a seed fund and maybe a $10 or $12 million fund and then do angel investing. I actually did a dry run with somebody whom I knew very well, who had just exited, who had a good brand name. But after a dry run of 6 months, both of us came to realize that we were more passionate about entrepreneurship and being in the trenches than being the coach. Because we felt we were young enough and we knew operating stuff enough that we wanted to learn how to build, you know, we wanted to learn how to fish than to, you know, teach someone how to fish. And so we said, you know what, we can still do investing as a part-time, as an angel and get the, you know, whatever we are looking from, you know, whether it's term of returning to the society or being in more friends with your startup and kind of being in the ecosystem, but we will pursue our own entrepreneurship journeys. And so we all decided to do our own startups.
When you say dry run, What does that consist of? Did you actually take money from others and start investing?
No, no, no. See, so dry run would absolutely not involve. See, once you take somebody's money, there is a fiduciary duty.
Yeah.
So both of us said, both of us will pool some money, and in 6 months we'll try to make investments together as if we are a fund. And I mean, we'll say everybody we are
so
angel investments.
You are not
we'll
taking
together.
Money, but you are just investing your own money.
Yeah, yeah. So in both cases, so even today, all the investments I made is from my own money. Now, somebody may say, okay, how does it come? So it's simple, right? A lot of you might have houses. You might have bought a house in US or in India. I never bought a house. And that's the money I kind of, you know, invest in startups.
Got it. No, I'm not worried. I'm curious to know what is like, if someone who is seriously considering investing in Indian startups, what kind of money are we looking at? Is it tens of thousands of dollars? Is it hundreds of thousands of dollars? Or is it
So a typical angel round in India is between 1 to 3 crores, and typical angel investment can invest anything between 3 lakhs to 10 lakhs.
Okay.
So you can get the answer. So let's say if you had only 50 lakhs and you were doing 5 lakhs a startup, you could technically do 10 startups. Or even you had 30 lakhs, you could
50 lakhs is close to $80,000.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. So, the idea is, so in a sense, average ticket size is between, you know, $7,000 to $10,000. But the point is, there are people who do even smaller sizes. But the question to ask is, what is it that you're looking for? If some people are doing for diversification and saying, okay, returns, I must add that it is extremely hard to get a return on any of such asset unless you're very diversified, which means you should have 30 to 40 investments to really make good returns. If you're doing fewer than that, like me, then you're taking high risk. But the risk I am taking, see, I'm not doing it for return, especially the angel side. It's mainly to, you know, learn from other entrepreneurs, be aware of certain spaces, and also participate. If I can get my principal back, I'll be very happy.
I see. When you returned from US, you were nine years out of the network, right? So Indian ecosystem must have been new, not just in terms of not just in terms of actual facts that you can learn from anywhere, right? But in terms of network that you have. And this is an extremely tight market as such, right? So outsiders are not always welcome as such. So
So I think it's probably true when it comes to maybe venture investing. But at that time also, angel was just starting to pick up. And so, but that being said, it took some time for me to build my network, I will say that. But what happened was I started this Region Capital entity around 2012 and told folks I'm going to be, you know, doing some angel investments and started getting invites. So I think because there were not so many investors like the US, still it is much easier to, you know, network. And I'll tell you what. So as an angel investor, folks from the venture community would want to interact a lot with you because they are looking for deals which are good. And you will be the person who are funding those deals, right?
Yeah.
So you would probably be, you know, because you're down the stream for them, right? So so in a sense, because of the size, I think it took a while. Of course, it takes a while, and I still don't know all the investors in India, but I know a huge, big number, because over time they all come to know each of us, and I think in a sense, it was a great community because it's been, you know, growing and investing a lot since last few years.
2012 must have been the prime time as well for the startup boom.
Absolutely.
Right. When I was looking at the word startup in Google search results from India, I believe from 2000 till 2013, it was like a straight line. And 2014 saw like a 10x increase in the people, amount of people searching startups on Google.
Absolutely.
So if the online searches took happened in 2014, I'm guessing backtracking it in the real world, it must have happened in 2013 or something around that time.
No, we have had our cycles in India too. Absolutely.
Okay. So you were mentioning earlier that you and your co-founder got really excited about actually executing rather than funding in other startups.
Right.
This was in early 2012. So what happened after that? What did you do with that realization?
So that's when I started looking for, you know, what is that I should do? I said, you know what, I want to build startups and I want to be an entrepreneur. Then I came up with this idea, how about I build first a cash business? I know it is not the most common option, but I build one cash business, and I had looked at similar models, and I build this cash business, and from that cash, then I start taking risk over a certain time. And then in that way, I'll be kind of a perpetual entrepreneur and, you know, I'll be having my own ability instead of taking somebody else's capital. I mean, so I I'm not against taking anybody's...
Just to clarify, right, Ravi, yeah. When you say cash business, it means something which generates constant cash flow, but it's not like a highly risky business also. So it doesn't grow like 10-fold, 50-fold, but it grows decently. It's just like a small business, but in a slightly larger scale. Is that
right? So not necessarily from the risk perspective or not necessarily from the growth. So there could be some large growth companies, or not large, but medium growth companies who still are good cash businesses, meaning who can throw cash. Mm-hmm. But in general, the idea was if there is a business that, if done well, can give a steady cash flow with decent growth, why not build it? And that's where I came up with couponing, because India was just growing in terms of e-commerce. Mm-hmm. I had this knowledge around e-commerce, having run or executed an online division in US, and I felt while couponing had a low barrier to entry, if the execution was done well, we could succeed. Also, we felt there were gaps because a lot of people in India at that time were only focused, and even today, only focused on what were technical considered paying stores, or stores which will give you commission. And mm-hmm. there was this dearth of coupons for, you know, stores that were not giving commission. Even other issues were around, people were still sharing or putting, you know, expired coupons, you know, just to make a little more commission. And we felt, you know, we wanted to be that site that made sure that we had only working coupons, right? So we felt there was an opportunity, and that's where we kind of said, okay, and it kind of fit well. The reason I said, so of course there have been investments in the space also, but when I say cash, I mean to say that I'm trading off some part of growth. Yes, bootstrap, and I'm trading some growth for maintaining margins or higher margins. So that's kind of the philosophy.
So you
we
don't
had.
Have to reinvest the cash in the business, but you can take it and invest it elsewhere.
Correct.
And this, yeah. And for some other growth-based company, taking the cash and putting it elsewhere kills the company. But for a cash business, it doesn't kill it as much.
Correct. And it's not always that you take the cash. The other thing is, you don't want to, once you're, you know, at a certain stage, you don't want to be, in some sense, you'll be making moves, but it'll not be like huge capital intensive. For example, I will say, if we were to ever think of going into offline coupons, mm-hmm. right, which means spas and something, that's something which requires huge investment. That's something which we're probably less likely to think of from the nature of what we charted out to do.
When did you buy the domain couponrunny.com?
Great question. Actually, July 2012.
Oh, so, okay.
And we started kind of, so my first hire was, I think, remember, I made it on June 26th or 27th, 2012. This was a gentleman who had good marketing and operations experience. He became my first employee and now actually the general manager. And we started, you know, first with a very basic design and something which we could get off the shelf to just understand the market. And then, you know, we actually bought the domain in July.
July, and when did you launch the first version of Couponrunny?
So technically our product, the moment we kind of bought the domain, we had something in WordPress. It was kind of launched with, of course, fewer stores, but we built our own product in-house, and the actual launch happened around October-November timeframe of 2012. And I would say that was still the first version of the product. Our own couponing, you know, infrastructure, everything. And it almost took a year and a half for it to kind of stabilize. And so that's how long it takes. I mean, on the surface, it seems maybe easy to build a couponing system or something that has that, but like to build a fully functional, also something that has a lot of efficiencies and operating stuff in it, like the way we wanted, it took us a while to build that.
Yeah. So building all this is a very technical thing to do, right? And you have not been doing the technical side of things for a decade almost at that time. So
sure.
How do you manage building, how do you manage the tech side of things?
Sure. So I brought in a CTO. So I will say that once a techie, always a techie. I'll begin by saying that.
Yeah.
So I still understand. In fact, in last 6 to 12 months, I've become, you know, I do DevOps, but that's besides the point. But what I was saying was, so at that point, absolutely, I knew I needed somebody to run technology for me. So I went out and got a CTO for my organization. I was lucky to find somebody who had just shut down his previous business, was good in technology. And I convinced him to move from Pune, and he moved to Bangalore and started, you know, working and building Couponrunny for us.
Yeah.
And that's how the journey started.
Building. I see. Did you have, you mentioned previously that you had some difficulties with hiring people in the beginning. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. So I think, in fact, so we were lucky to have our CTO with us in you know, August 2012, but because he came from Pune and he had a family who lived in Pune, he used to commute, you know, once a month, and that's the model we had. And this went on till, you know, December, January, and his plan was to move his family and everybody to Bangalore. But around Feb, he said that was not going to happen, and that's kind of a big challenge we faced, because our CTO was saying, hey, you know what, I want to leave. And it was part personal and also part company related, because by the time it was just so early in the innings, we hadn't seen much growth. We were just, you know, slowly making progress. Maybe he felt this was great, but or maybe he was not too bullish. Also, he had this personal stuff. So that was kind of our first moment of crisis. And luckily, we did try to hire some good leads, and we were actually, I would say, somewhat lucky to hire somebody really good at that time. And in fact, my CTO only helped close that position. So we were able to manage the transition. But that was kind of the first setback we
losing
had.
Losing a CTO in middle of building something significant like what you did must have been definitely difficult.
Absolutely. It gave me a lot of sleepless nights.
Yeah, I can imagine. I'm curious to know at this time, which I must have asked this earlier, but your co-founder with Srijan Capital, was he still with you, or were you doing this all by yourself?
No. So I'm doing it. So the person whom I actually decided to do the dry run, we didn't call it Srijan Capital or anything, because we both were doing Angel. So he went on to do something else. He in fact made a movie in Bollywood and all that. See, he's just doing something else.
Got it. You parted ways. So you were doing it all by yourself.
Yes. Okay, with help from my early employees who are like partners.
But the founder is only you. Mostly.
That's correct. Okay. Right. From that perspective. Yeah.
Got it. So, Coupon Rani, like you were mentioning, right, in early 2013, wasn't getting much traction from the marketing standpoint.
Right.
But
right.
then you made a hire of an intern, which turned things around, right? So, tell us about it.
Sure. So I think this was one of our moves where we took some risks. I had one person. So at that time, what happened was I used to get invites from certain, you know, organizations for speaking and marketing, because they knew I was doing digital marketing and I knew some bit of it. And I used to speak on this course called Growth Hacking or Digital Marketing 101. So in one of those courses I went and did, I found one person who was very interested. He was actually at an IT services company and he was on bench. So he was getting immensely bored and he really enjoyed marketing. And after that session, he kept pestering me and saying, you know what, I want to work as an intern. I am anyway sitting idle. I like this stuff. I have done WordPress blogs. I have this many sites I've written. Can you just allow me to join you as an intern? So we said, fine, I know you're very interested. Why don't you come and work 10 days as an intern? And that's how we actually got him, or 15 days. And we saw him and he was really, you know, very interested. So he was trying many stuff. We gave him a few new ideas and he actually became one of the stars at that point. And we were lucky to actually, I mean, of course, make a full-time offer. He worked with us for around 6 months and then he decided to start.
Can you mention one thing that he implemented as an intern?
Sure. So one of the things, so again, after some time with the full time, so one of the things we succeeded, for example, was doing a Twitter campaign on Republic Day. And he said, let's do a trivia contest on Republic Day. It was all his stuff. We're just going to be lazing around on Republic Day. But he said, let's do a trivia contest on Republic Day. We'll ask people one question about Republic Day and we'll see how it goes. And as you know, and now we realize, people are very patriotic on that day. And if you ask a trivia, this was a trivia with no prizes. Okay. Mm-hmm. We said every 30 minutes, we'll ask a question. There were 15 questions. And that, you know, Rani contest, or I forget the name, Rani Republic Day, became a number one trend that day.
Nice.
And people were asking, which Rani is this? This is Rani Mukherjee. Like, no, this is Coupon Rani. So anyway, so the thing is, that was our first sweet success. By the way, by that time, none of the spam in Twitter used to be there. I mean, it was not so spammy. Now there is so much of spam out there for number one trend that people do all crazy stuff. But I mean, those days, I still think they were genuine, you know, number one spots. And so we were very proud of that. So that's one, I would say. Number two, we used to do good content and we picked up on certain SEO stuff with him, and it's like, you know, if you have 2-3 people with like-minded frequency exploring, you know, you can achieve a lot.
Yeah,
and
the result is exponentially bigger.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you.
I was saying we always look for contrarian and new ideas, and we were, you know, able to do that along together in a great way.
New ideas, but aligning philosophies.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, so we do take risk, and that's what has helped. See, at times when we take risk, you know, we have found some great successes as well. So,
how were you at that time? There were already other coupon sites, right?
Yes.
You mentioned, I'm not sure if you mentioned earlier, you were focused only on online coupons, which
Correct.
Means the product has to be sold online and the coupon has to be redeemed online,
online.
As well.
Yeah.
Right? Why were you focused just on online? Why not other things?
Sure. So I think one of the things we realized was for online, there was a huge scale that we got with, let's say, a team that was sourcing coupons, doing partnerships, versus offline where it was like a boutique store or maybe mid-sized store. And so for each city, you had to do so many tie-ups. So at that time, if you look at a Groupon or somebody else who did the offline couponing, they had huge sales force. Right. And that's where I said a huge sales force implies huge capital investment. And we were looking for more scalable models where, you know, with very little, you know, sales force, we are able to do many tie up and we are able to, you know, source many coupons and aggregate them and kind of show them. And I think the other thing we did was we focused so much on exclusive coupons. We tried to cut so many deals with our online merchants, because when people come to your site, they're looking for exclusive coupons, right? Because that's how you differentiate, by having those. And so we actually worked on those, and but that's all the reason why we actually, you know, focused on online, which is mainly the scale part. It was much scalable and, you know, worked suitable for our model.
Did you have to pay a lot to get the domain? I forgot to ask earlier. Coupon.
No. So at that time, it was just available at that time.
I see. Nice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's
and
see.
By the way, we aren't the kind of guys who will pay a lot to get the domain. We are bootstrap, remember? So
yeah.
I don't believe for once that, I mean, okay, maybe later on, but no, not at all. I mean, I don't think it's a good use of money. So.
I see. So what were some of the growth hacks that you implemented? I know you talk about at length about
sure.
this stuff, right, in conferences
sure.
and whatnot. So
sure.
what were some of the things that you implemented in 2013 and 2014 that helped you
sure.
grow?
So I think some of the hacks were around organic search, around, you know, understanding what drove better customer engagement. See, one thing we realized was those people who were chasing Google were chasing the wrong thing, instead chasing the customers who actually come on your site and engage with you is even more important. So we found that things like how much time a user spends on your page, how is the bounce rate of a page, how fast does the page load, are far more important than any other factors in getting ranked in Google, right? And how fresh is the content. And so that's kind of the thing that we began with the end user first, and that actually drove us to do the right thing against, you know, majority of the world who is just saying, hey, build this link, do this spammy stuff. So that's kind of the first thing we did from the SEO perspective. Now, as it relates to other tactics, whether it is, you know, social, I already shared how we did some kind of community building in the Twitter example, but let's say in AdWords, right, or in Facebook, any of these ad platforms, one example which I give everybody in my growth hack class is that one of the common things we do is when we are said, whatever the options the platform gives, we opt for that. For example, when you run a Facebook campaign and it's a like campaign, you would most likely click on the option where it says optimize for like, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where it says. But what we have always found is when you do the contrarian thing, you are not always, but there are times when you do the contrarian thing, your efficiencies are much higher.
Yeah.
So we have been always, you know, experimenting a lot. And this is a true example. For 3 years back, if you were optimized for click or something else, we got a much cheaper like. And so that's an example. You can't call it a full hack, but these are some of the things, whether
so
it's on the paid side.
Just to be clear, when you are promoting an ad on Facebook, if you say optimized for like, you get, let's say, 1,000 likes and it costs you some money. But
Correct.
When you tell the same page, optimize for clicks instead, you got more likes and you got the clicks also, and you spent
Correct.
Lesser anyway.
Absolutely. That's what I'm
got
saying.
Got it.
But it worked that time. Now it doesn't, just letting you know. So don't try it. But we tried. So there are always some of these, you know. So remember, growth hacks are always short-lived.
Yeah.
They are not long lived, because growth hacks after some time get because competitors may come. It's the best practices that are long lived. So best practices we always follow or try to, but it's the growth hacks that we try to find. And it's in a month we find one, then you can actually make a huge difference in terms of, you know, profitable acquisition or in terms of, you know, and that's kind of the stuff that we always keep looking out for.
When did you move? In what time frame? Is it 2013 and 2014? What time frame you moved from, you know, just another coupon site to one of the biggest coupon sites in the country?
I think it was around 2013 end or 2014 January or February that we started moving in a big way. And we started appearing in top three of many results. And we, I think that's when we kind of reached that stature of, you know, being the top three site in India.
And what were your revenues by that time?
So like I said, we did around 10 to 40,000. So maybe it would have been 30 to 50,000 transactions at that time. See, in general, wherever it's listed, we just state that we do between $100,000 to $1 million in revenue in a year. So that's how I leave it at. I think when we were at peak, we have had some good days as well. That's what I would say.
Obviously, it's financially successful as well, right? So, personally, what did it mean for you, Ravi? I'm curious to know, did your life become different in any way?
No. Actually, what it meant was, okay, if I had some cash, so first thing I did was make sure whatever. So by the way, remember when I started, I had to invest some money to kind of get this started, right? So I kind of, you know, ate the cost. So it kind of recovering that. And then later it was, okay, let's keep the cash for maybe some other idea or for maybe tough times, right? So in a sense, there hasn't been, you know, any cash withdrawal or anything like a major event where I've, let's say, bought a Ferrari or something. But it's just, you know, maybe I have a little more cushion that if I do a startup, I have some money to maybe. Yeah. See, my passion is still, and I've said this openly, I want to build a company, a startup from scratch, which gets on to do 100 million in revenue. Yeah. And I will not stop till I get there. Maybe I took a longer route. Maybe this is not the most common route, but that's what I'm slowly building towards, right? And so I think it just gave us a cash to maybe, you know, do a little more experimentation. In fact, what we did with some of the cash was we actually launched Singapore and Malaysia. So we have a coupon site in Singapore and Malaysia. And we operate still Malaysia. So we shut down Singapore, but Malaysia still exists.
Now, the reason I asked that question is so many listeners or people who I talk to, they say, guy made a fortune
I'm still not there, I'm in work in progress.
Even if you made a fortune, so what I noticed it is when people say, oh, he made a fortune, he's so lucky, and what I notice people saying is even people who made a fortune aren't really interested in the fortunes themselves. It's just a byproduct of what they're doing and what they've been passionate about.
Absolutely. No, I agree. And I think I wish I will be able to say the same someday. It's still there, getting there.
So how did the idea for your second company, pushengage.com, come about?
Sure. And actually, it came from Coupon Rani itself. So like I said, we always were looking out for new marketing channels, new methods. So this actually was our engagement hack. So what happened was in Chrome in April 2015 announced support for browser push. We all are aware of push notification in mobile apps, but it was not in the browsers. Chrome said they'll support it. So we built a tool and we started using it just like we were doing emailing. And once we started seeing some results coming out of this notification in terms of transactions and click rate, we were just amazed. And when I looked around at that time, I found there were hardly any companies who were actually doing any kind of so there were only a few companies who were giving this as a tool. Mm-hmm. And then I said, you know what, this is a new channel which has just come about with superior, ROI over email. As a marketing channel, this is going to grow almost like email. So let's make it a SaaS product. And that's when our journey started. So around August, we started making the product open for everybody. And in December 2015, we launched the product. And that's how PushEngage started. And that in some sense, Coupon Rani's cash or Coupon Rani invested in PushEngage and, you know, and kind of helped build, you know, so far. And, you know, and we've been doing very well in PushEngage.
So. Also, it's also profitable and you plan to use that for another company down there.
Sure. No, I mean, it's still not profitable. I'll say Push Engage, but I'll give you some stats. So Push Engage is right now, we believe, among the leaders in the space, live in 115 countries. We have over 6,000 sites globally using us. This includes the like of Vogue in Taiwan, Times Now in India, Ajio, Reliance, or, you know, right now, we've just gone or about to go live with Indeed.com in USA. So we're a top brands. They consider us, and we think we are easily the top two or three in this space globally. Mm-hmm. And but our journey has just started. It's only 14 months old, and we still have a lot of work to do. But I'm very happy that this SaaS product came about. I'll tell you one more thing. See, doing a consumer company and doing a SaaS company are two entirely different things.
Yeah.
And I oftentimes like to maybe stretch myself, but it's given me very different perspective. But there are some good things in consumer company that focus on the customer that actually now is coming to enterprise companies or SaaS companies that actually makes me feel that I have a better chance of succeeding. Same with the marketing.
Pushing is also consumer, right? Or are you focusing more on enterprise customers?
So remember, I talked about the customers
Indeed,
we have.
Vogue
is a Condé Nast group, right?
Yeah.
Of course, we don't have a sales force which does. This is all inbound and maybe over the phone and demo kind of a stuff. But still, these are large corporations who are using it. So it's B2B and B2C. Like, you could be a small blogger.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah,
you could be a large blogger, you could be a large content site. So, yeah, so it depends, right?
Got it.
So,
but you are going after the enterprise more, which makes it B2B more.
No, I'm not. I'm going equally, I'll say. I'm still not sure. The answer I was going to, what I was trying to say was, see, what you've seen recently is that because of so much of the enterprise product becoming closer to consumer product in terms of the experience, that's the knowledge I feel or the experience I have had. Mm-hmm. The bar is much higher when you build a consumer product, because if the consumer doesn't stick to your page or website, he just goes away, right?
Yeah.
And whereas the enterprise product earlier used to be, you know, one of those which didn't have a good UI. And what I'm trying to say is that that product and the marketing, which is much harder in consumer space, right? Because you got to get millions of visits somehow, right? And so I feel confident that those skills, while, you know, are slightly different, but will help us, you know, build a better product. And being a marketer myself, this is a tool by the marketer for the marketer. And that's kind of what I feel will give us more success. But I'm very happy with the way things are progressing so far with Push Engage.
I'm seeing one more thing in outbound marketing space that people are building a lot of products around, and I want to get your opinion on it.
Sure.
Messenger bots, especially Facebook Messenger bots. Messengers have a very higher amount of click-through rates and engagement rates than traditional email, right? I'm not sure how it compares to notifications. I'm curious to know, what do you think about messenger marketing?
See, I still think it's in infancy.
Yeah.
It could be on our roadmap too, I will say that.
We
have looked at it. In fact, one of my companies I've invested in, they have a bot for Slack and they are doing very well. It's an investment of mine. So I have seen the space. I will say that the results so far have been mixed for some brands that have worked well, but it is still TBD. And I still think there is a huge potential in there. And if me as a company would think of it, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are some brands. So, for example, I get my TechCrunch in my Messenger.
Yeah. I was going to say the exact same thing. Me and TechCrunch are using it.
That's what I get my TechCrunch from. So I know there is a use case out there and customers are using it. I don't have that exact data to say, is it, because I've heard mixed stuff from other companies in the space, right? In some brands, it has worked for consumer brands, but certain things like news and others,
mm-hmm.
it has worked very well. So I think this, it has a great place to, you know, operate in. And I will say there are some competitors, I mean, not direct, but slightly adjacent spaces where who are in the space have launched Messenger bot as additional channel of outbound. And so we are looking at that intently as well.
You mentioned what's next for Push Engage, but what is next for Coupon Ronnie?
You know, it's great. So, see, I feel what is happening right now, again, if you look at the lay of the land, in more recent days, e-commerce is going through a tough space in India, tough times in India. We have had lack of funding. We have had, you know, large companies who were, you know, valued at X, now valued at X by 2. So this is kind of a shrinking of a cycle, so which actually also puts some stress. But I feel this is an opportunity in itself for sites in this space. So if you are right sized with the right economics, with the right model, you will actually win in the end. And so the right now the time is to hold on to what we have, continue to do more of it. We continue to focus on mid-tier merchants, which means we will make sure anybody who is selling online is able to have a listing on my site and drive more transactions through us, which is where we're going to, you know, hopefully become top in that space, the mid-tier. So right now I have 3,600 merchants. So for me, it is all about more execution in the same geo, but becoming, you know, top of mind when it comes to mid-tier merchants. And because the times are tough, I think in 2-3 years, if we continue to execute well, we'll come out on top of all this. And we might consider some more geos in Southeast Asia opportunistically, like Philippines or some other.
Yeah, you already have one from Malaysia, right?
Yes, absolutely. So we are looking at that. But like I said, we when we get into, we kind of cautiously enter it, and you know, we have to, you know, execute 100% and nail it down. So
what advice do you have for someone else who's starting out?
Yeah, I think the biggest advice which I got and I have seen is never give up. If there's only one success of one secret for success in startups is never give up. There are so many times where you feel like this is crazy, this is shit, you have seen far better days and this is like horrible, and I trust me, it might be, but when it comes better, it is so much better. So I think that's the only advice I give. Even though you may be down, I'm not saying not look at the signals, not be pragmatic about what to build your product on, be open to learning from market and pivoting and doing what it requires to do, but I am saying don't give up. If you give up, that's kind of a sure shot way of, you know, being
it's hard to maintain that balance that you said, right, Ravi? Like not to give up, at the same time not to be foolishly after something which is not
absolutely
being after.
No, that's equally important. So because sometimes the only reason we got into the startup is that we believed in certain ideas so much that we left everything, right? So it's kind of a paradox. Because we believed in it, that's why we got in. But to actually succeed, you got to, you know, listen to others. So it's kind of a hard skill to, you know, while at some stage we've totally convinced about it, but on the other stage, based on market, you know, be ready to open and kind of change. But I think that's the right balance, the right entrepreneurs or the successful ones get.
Yeah. So before I ask you where people can find you, is there anything that I should have asked you that I didn't?
No, I think you covered a lot of stuff. I think you covered a lot of good stuff. So.
Okay. Yeah, I make sure I ask that question because sometimes I know the person will be dying to talk about something. And
I usually am. You actually, by the way, on a separate note, you're asking my interview question. I interview for Duke MBS kids, and this is my final closing question to them. So, but nonetheless, I think I covered. And I mean, yeah. I'm happy to answer anything specific you're looking for. Yeah. But I think I shared a lot of my story, and I hope it really interests your users.
I mean, it was the biggest test I go through is it interesting for me and for. I'm sure it was. I really had a great conversation, and thank you so much for being here. But before we part here, if someone who is listening to us wants to find you online, what is the best way for them to connect with you? Can you give your Twitter handle and other things?
Sure. So I think best is Twitter. It's Trivedi Ravi, at Trivedi Ravi. Other option could be you could email me. I'm ravi@pushengage.com or ravi@couponrani.com. Either of those emails work. I do try to respond to emails, but only one ask I have. If you do reach out, please be very specific in what you're looking for, so that I can specifically, you know, address what you're looking for. That's what I could say. I'm happy to help all entrepreneurs.
I will leave that information in the show notes as well. Ravi, this has been a blast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Thank you for tuning in. To get updates on latest episodes, make sure you subscribe with your email by going over to breakingtheborders.com. If you know anyone good as a guest, shoot me an email. I will reach out to the guest, get hold of them, and ask them all the questions that you have. My email is rohit@breakingtheborders.com. Thanks again and have an amazing day.